The IWARD Showcase is Iowa Public Radio's monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. June and July are overflowing with an abundance of brilliant arts and musical events. We'll hit the road with the Heartland Marimba Festival Ensemble. We'll congratulate Mason City's McNider Art Museum on their 50 years of artistic excellence. We'll revel with the Waterloo Center for the Arts as they turn 50 and commemorate Grant Wood's 125th birthday. We'll investigate the long history and tradition behind Iowa's municipal bands. And we'll get the inside scoop on King Lear performances at Salisbury House and their amazing garage makeover. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
We are so fortunate to have this in our own backyard right here in Des Moines. And I just invite anyone to come in for a tour. It's really quite spectacular, and there is absolutely nothing like it anywhere in the Midwest. And the collection is so vast, has everything from paintings to sculptures to weapons to a wonderful library. Carl Weeks was a very avid and dedicated collector of rare books. We have first editions of a page of the Gutenberg Bible, and one of the things with regards to Shakespeare that we have in our collection is we have his second folio, a 1632 second folio edition of Shakespeare's Comedies, Histories, and Tragedies. We've got a 1681 edition of Othello, a 1703 edition of The Tragedy of Hamlet. There's so many things that are unique in Salisbury House. And one of the kind of tales that a lot of people believe about Salisbury House is the house was deconstructed in Salisbury, England, and brought over across the ocean and rebuilt in Des Moines. That is not the case. Several of the components of the house were brought over from England. In fact, in our great hall, you will find the ceiling, actually ceiling beams that were once in Salisbury, England, in a place that Shakespeare was known to frequent. So when the RTI cast was in the house last night, they all looked up at the ceiling and said, "Oh my gosh, we're under the hallowed beams that Shakespeare once stood under as well." So there's so many unique qualities to the house.
Salisbury House and Gardens Executive Director, Kit Curran. Salisbury's Kit Curran, along with its curator-historian Megan Stout-Sibyl, are spiffing up the estate's garage and joining forces with the Repertory Theater of Iowa to commemorate the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death by presenting one of his most powerful dramas at one of Iowa's most unusual architectural gems.
On June 16th through the 19th, we will be presenting Shakespeare on the Lawn. We have been doing this for many years. This year, we are very excited to be presenting King Lear. This is one of the first times we're doing a tragedy. The Salisbury House is really a unique venue for the presentation of William Shakespeare's plays because there's so many elements of the house, the estate, and the collection that really relate to Shakespeare and his era.
This is out on the lawn. How does this all work?
It's such a wonderful backdrop. We use our south terrace as the stage and part of the lawn. And with the backdrop at Salisbury House of the building and the Carolean brickwork of the estate and the English Tudor stonework and the Gothic arches, it's an absolutely perfect backdrop. They need very few props. We have a balcony on the house that they are able to use as well, so it's such a dramatic backdrop that it's just the perfect stage for Shakespeare's works.
Give us just a quick synopsis of King Lear.
It is not a happy ending, but it's basically about the father and his three daughters and the tragedy that ensues over his kingdom. And tickets are on sale now on our website, salisburyhouse.org. Then we have, in case unfortunately rains, we will have a Monday performance as well. But we're really excited, and rehearsals are underway, and the Repertoire Theater of Iowa stopped by last night and walked out the grounds, and it's absolutely wonderful working with RTI, and we really look forward to the performance.
And tickets are also available at the door as well.
Most certainly, absolutely. It's really a nice backdrop because you can bring your picnic lunch and sit down on a blanket and enjoy your wine and cheese or whatnot as you watch the performance. And so you can also purchase it while you're there at the event, but you can certainly bring that with you. And it is really something that is very unique because you will never see anything like this in Iowa with a backdrop of our beautiful estate and the wonderful performance. It's just one of the most unique and exciting things you can do this summer.
And tell us about this, the garage. You have something new that you've just started this year.
The garage at Salisbury House is something that we really started thinking about last fall. And the idea was to utilize space in the museum to host a rotating slate of, on the one hand, guest-curated art shows, and on the other hand, history exhibits dedicated to the stories of Salisbury House and exhibits drawing on the Salisbury House permanent collection. So really our mission with the garage is to provide space for moments of community, art, and history, and also promoting the legacy of Carl and Edith Weeks, but also, you know, a way to bring a new slate of rotating shows and exciting and interesting new works of art to Salisbury House.
Tell us about the show that's going to be opening on June 23rd.
Our next show is a guest-curated show. It's called Le Garage Hermétique, and it considers the ancient connection between science and magic. So looking back to the Greek god Hermes, up through the medieval alchemists, the natural philosophers, and early modern scientists. So that's kind of the inspiration for the show, and we have 14 different artists who will have their work included in the show, each sort of interpreting that overarching theme in terms of the production of their own work for the show. It's going to be fantastic. The opening is the 23rd from 6 to 8, so we're hoping to get folks who are in town for the art festival up to Salisbury House as well. It's going to be fantastic. And on July 14th, we're going to have a piece of programming related to the show. It's just going to be a great evening. We're going to have a couple of artists come and talk about their work. We're going to have some tarot card readings, some drinks, some sangria maybe, just have a fun kind of summer's evening outing at Salisbury House tied to this particular show.
Who are some of these 14 artists that will be showing their works?
Some of the artists included in the show, Jeff Ash, Brad Ball, Chris Haynes, Joel Heron, Scott Schobachen, Molly Wood, Michael Van Dyke, Eric Wicks. It's a wonderful list of artists. And each, I think, certainly bring their own interesting style and interpretation to the show. So it's going to be a really diverse, unique, and interesting show.
And coming up at the garage, you're planning on doing part of the permanent collection, and then you're going to have another guest-curated show.
The remaining slate of shows for 2016, after Le Garage Hermétique in July through early August, on Saturday, August 20th, we will be opening an exhibit entitled That's Not Art. And the show is going to draw on the legendary 1913 Armory show in New York City. So this is the first time that a large American audience sees works by these emerging modernist European artists, so Matisse, Picasso, Cezanne, others. And the title, That's Not Art, comes from Theodore Roosevelt, who actually attended the opening and wrote this famous review of the show. Roosevelt reportedly sort of strode around the opening shouting, "That's not art," in response to these European modernist works. Of course, today we look upon works by these artists as masterpieces. So at heart, the exhibit sort of considers the way in which response to art changes over time and draws on pieces from our permanent collection for the show itself. So that'll be open August 20th through October 2nd. And then the final show that we'll have in 2016 is called Project Bridge. Our guest curator for that show is Matt Greiner, and it's part of an emerging artist endeavor where Matt and other local established artists sort of work with young and upcoming artists to get them experience in terms of creating work for a show and installing the work for the show. So for that, the artists included will be Heidi Warren Bartlett, Tatiana Klusak, Candida Pagan, and Brianne Trammell. So it's, again, going to be a neat, interesting group of artists coming together for that show as well. That'll be opening October 13th through November 20th. And if you go to salisburyhouse.org and in the About Us tab, there's a page for the garage with information about our upcoming shows. The openings, we don't necessarily ticket. Typically, we have a sort of an event page for those for people to RSVP if they would like, but there's no ticket sort of requirement for the openings. And then after the opening night event, just, you know, come to Salisbury House for a regular tour, and that will grant you access to the garage shows as well. And I would encourage anyone who hasn't been to Salisbury House before, or who maybe haven't been in a while, to come back and see us. We've got some really fantastic things happening in terms of both our programming and the house and collection itself. So come on and come on.
Salisbury House's curator historian Megan Stout Sybil, along with executive director Kit Curran. Just ahead, we'll hear about the Heartland Marimba Festival's 2016 summer tour. We'll applaud the Waterloo Center for the Arts for their upcoming anniversary and their celebration of the 125th anniversary of Grant Wood's birth. We'll see how municipal and community bands are revving up for the summer. And we'll congratulate the McNider Art Museum for their 50 years of excellence in Mason City. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
The museum was started in 1964, and the building that we're in now was actually owned by St. Joseph's Catholic Church, and they actually used it as a nunnery. It had been a private home in the 20s and 30s, and then it was purchased by the church and used as a nunnery from the 1940s through the 1960s. So the city leaders talked to Hanford McNider and asked him and his wife to purchase the building and then to give it to the city of Mason City to be used as an art center. And so that's what they did. So again, this all happened in 1964. Richard Leet, who was the first director of the museum, was hired in 1965, and he really got everything going as far as the remodel, what they would need to have here at the museum to be a functioning museum. And then in 1966, the museum opened to the public. And the museum does focus on American art. We also have a quite a large collection of Bill Baird puppets and marionettes, most famous for being in The Sound of Music, the goat herding scene.
We decided that it would be nice to celebrate the anniversary for the entire year. So over the course of this entire 50th year, we're doing a number of different things. So we chose June as our month to have a focus on some of the events that will bring people from not only Mason City, but from around the state and probably from different states as well.
The Charles H. McNider Art Museum's Associate Curator and Registrar, Mara Linsky-Deegan, and the Board of Directors member, Barb McGregor. The McNider Art Museum's board has been working over a year to plan their 50th with something special. They decided to incorporate a film and invite its creator, former Iowa native Tim Jennison, to be a part of the festivities. Tim grew up in Belmont and still has family in Clear Lake. He said he'd be happy to come back to Mason City and celebrate for a week with them. Barb McGregor.
Tim's story is such an interesting one because he describes himself before doing this movie as someone who was about as interested in as the person next door. And he became fascinated with Johann Vermeer. And it was from there that he really changed the course of his life for 5 years to work on the production of this movie called Tim's Vermeer. It was produced by Penn and Teller. And it started out, Tim had this idea when he looked at Vermeer paintings, his area of expertise is computer graphics. And he spent his whole life working with video reproductions. So when he looked at Vermeer's work, it fascinated him because he saw things in it that very much made him think that there was some kind of mechanical assistance. And in telling that story to his friends Penn and Teller, they said, well, what are you going to do with this information? And Tim said, well, maybe I'll make a YouTube. And it was Penn and Teller's idea that this was a bigger story than that, and they began filming him. And so the project that he thought would take about a year to do ended up really being the focus of his life for 5 years. And the result is this amazing movie called Tim's Vermeer. And his story is pretty compelling. He started out at Iowa State University and dropped out. And he said he liked to play in a rock and roll band, and he liked to go to the engineering library and read. So he started out realizing that he could fix almost anything. He had this gift. He grew up with in the computer age. He liked to create both hardware, and he built his first computer when he was in the seventh grade. And that interest just continued to percolate, and he invented a product called Video Toaster. And it started something that hadn't been done in terms of using a laptop computer to present video programs. When Tim entered the field, cost about $100,000 to set up. And Tim's invention with Video Toaster dropped that cost to about $4,000. And from there, he just kept inventing one product after another. And he started a company called NewTek in 1985. And this is a multinational business that's still owned privately in San Antonio, Texas. So Tim's story is pretty remarkable in many, many ways. And the best part is he's just such a nice person. So he's going to be great fun to have him in North Iowa. And I hope lots of people will come and take advantage of this opportunity to get to know him and to talk to him, because there are many venues in which you will be able to ask him questions. On June 21st, the first day he gets here, there's going to be a lunch and learn. And then later in the evening from 5 to 7 at the Lake Time Brewery, there's going to be a tech brew, which is just a nice time to talk with Tim. And he's been in contact with a man in Great Britain as an art instructor, and he's used Tim's technique of copying paintings, and this man in Britain has used it to help teach his students how to draw. It's been very successful. So Tim thought it would be fun for him to try to do that in a workshop. So we're going to have three sessions on the 22nd, one session from 11 to 12:30, another session from 2 to 3:30, and another session from 6 to 7:30. There's no fee for this, but we do ask for advance registration. He's invited people from the age of 8 all the way up to whoever wants to come. So it's an intergenerational workshop, and I think it's going to be really fascinating. On the 23rd, there will be an entrepreneurial exchange, and this also will be at the McNider Museum. It will be from 6:30 to 8 p.m., and he's going to tell his story then and answer questions. So it should be very interesting. And then really the culmination of that week, we're extremely excited about. We're going to have a reception and a gala, which will include a beautiful dinner. There'll be an art show that will open that night, which is called Drawn to Abstraction, and we'll start with having the opening at the museum, and then we'll move to the Music Man Square for a beautiful dinner. And after the dinner, Tim will screen his movie, Tim's Vermeer, and have a question and answer session afterwards.
Now, this exhibit you mentioned, this Drawn to Abstraction, that opens on June 24th. And this is kind of fun, too, because you have 50 works in this, and it isn't what you might ordinarily see in an art museum.
Drawn to Abstraction is actually a traveling exhibition, and it's coming to us from the Kalamazoo Institute of the Arts in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And it's an exhibition that features pop art, mostly, from the late 50s all the way through the 70s. And we really ask them, when it comes to us, to highlight the pieces from the 60s, since the museum was founded in the 60s. So you're going to see works from people like Roy Lichtenstein, Andy Warhol, different people like that. And these are all going to be prints. So that's kind of neat. There's going to be art prints that people can come and see. And some of them are people that we have in our collection, and some of them are people that we don't have in our collection. So it'll be a really fun time to kind of celebrate art in the 60s.
And then you also have your 50 favorites, which I think is kind of fun.
Yes, events. And that's something we definitely want to highlight. You can go onto our website, which is macniderart.org, and right on the front page, you can actually click on a link that takes you to the voting area. You can actually go through, and we have about 150 pieces from our collection that you can go through and pick the 10 you like the best and vote on those. And you can vote right there on the website. And then at the end of our voting period, which ends August 1st, we will go through and the 50 pieces that get the most votes will be on exhibition in our larger temporary exhibition space starting in September. And they'll be on view so people can come and really see the highlights of our collection. And for all of our events, for any scheduling, they can visit our website, macniderart.org. And that really has everything that you would need to know. It has all the information about the exhibits coming up, about the 50th anniversary celebration, and all of the different events, because I know there are quite a bit going on, especially in June. So definitely if you visit that, and it has our contact information as well. So if people have further questions, they can always call the museum.
And we're very excited about this celebration and would hope that lots of people will look on the website and come and join us.
The Charles H. McNider Art Museum's Board of Directors member, Barb McGregor, and Associate Curator and Registrar, Mara Linsky-Deegan. Other 50th anniversary activities include a documentary on the McNider's history, acquiring new artwork, growing the endowment fund, selling McNider note cards, and offering a special coloring book along with a coloring contest. In addition to their 50th anniversary week from June 21st through the 24th, they will also be hosting their annual arts festival on June 11th. Don't go away. We'll see how the Waterloo Center for the Arts commemorates Grant Wood's birthday and celebrates their 50th anniversary. We'll hear about the history of the band movement in Iowa. And we'll marvel at the amazing summer performing plans of the Heartland Marimba Ensemble coming to a venue near you. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
There's something for everyone in the music, but also I believe that marimba, it speaks to everyone in a way that a lot of musical instruments don't, because the visual aspect of it directly relates to what you're hearing. So it gives the listener kind of almost a full sensory experience. And if you're not so familiar with the instrument, that's okay, because you quickly can see what the artist is doing physically to make things happen, so it doesn't stay a mystery for so long. And then you can kind of jump into that stage of just really enjoying what you're hearing and seeing. And that's how I fell in love with the marimba as like a 10 or 11 year old, was watching someone play, and the movement really spoke to me as much as the sound that I was hearing. And it's really amazing that a tree from Central America produces this organic material that will do this. and then through years and decades of exploration, we've been able to craft it into something that is comparable to any other musical instrument.
Artistic director and performing artist of the Heartland Marimba Festival, Dr. Matthew Colley. The Heartland Marimba Festival is expanding its wings. Their first big event this summer is their Academy Out West, which they are holding in Cedar City, Utah.
At Southern Utah University, Lynn Vartan, who is a marimba artist, will be hosting the Heartland Marimba Festival Academy. And we will have several artists, including Michael Burritt, who was a teacher of mine at Northwestern. And we will have Clocks in Motion Percussion, which is a quartet that I'm a member of, percussion quartet. So Lynn and myself will also be there as solo artists, and we're going to have a week of concerts and events there. And one of the great features of this academy is Alex Orfali, who is a composer. He is also the timpanist of the San Francisco Symphony. He wrote us a marimba quartet, and we will be premiering that in Utah. Clocks in Motion Percussion will premiere that. And I believe he's going to be coming out there to see the premiere. So that's a very special part of what we are doing in Utah, and a special part of what we do as modern artist. We get to work with living composers. And all the students at the academy get to experience a wide range of opportunities. Not only are they doing kind of normal student things for a summer camp, but they're also kind of being introduced or submerged into maybe more of a professional life. And the recording sessions that we offer them, we want to prepare them for this kind of modern day life of being a performing artist. And there's lots of performing opportunities for them in different settings.
So tell us about the touring ensemble and what you're going to be playing on your tour.
Sure. On tour with us this summer, we're going to have three different sizes. We're going to have a 5.5, a 5-octave, and a 4.3. We're also going to have a xylophone with us, which is in the family of mallet percussion instruments or keyboard percussion instruments. It has a different range. The tuning of the bars is different in that they tune the overtones a little bit differently, so you get a traditional, familiar xylophone sound. The bars are also thicker. You use harder mallets, so you get a sharper kind of sound of a xylophone. And this is very exciting this year. Very important part of the mission is getting the marimba out into the community and really speaking to the community and not just kind of keeping it sort of esoteric in the university. You need to start getting it into the community and showing it off so that all these great performers have opportunities. So on tour, we're going to play a wide variety of music. We held for composers contest about 2 months ago. We chose two composers. Adam Silverman was our first place composer, and we will perform his piece. His piece is called The Cruel Waters, and it's a marimba trio. Also, Caleb Pickering was our second place composition winner, and his work, Blood Works, will be performed at our academy out west by students. Also on tour, we're going to do a lot of audience favorite pieces like Yankee Doodle Fantasy, selections from the opera Carmen, Stars and Stripes Forever. We will also be performing some really fun works where there's kind of running around behind the instrument with three players, a piece called Stubernick by one of my other teachers, Mark Ford. Our show also involves some duo music, a piece called Red by Mark Mellitz. And there are many other, you know, fun pieces that we have about 9 pieces on the program. And we're thinking of everyone when we're programming. So we're really trying to keep it light. Oh, we're also doing ragtime. So one of the artists will play xylophone ragtime, and the ensemble will accompany him on marimba ensemble.
So how many folks will be in your touring ensemble?
This year it's 5, myself, and then we have 2 doctoral students from the University of Iowa, one who just graduated, so he is now Dr. Andrew Veit, and Christine Augsberger, she's a doctoral candidate. Sean Cleave, he is actually a doctor too. He is the leader of Clocks in Motion Percussion, and Sean and I have been working a lot together. And Kyle Flins is our apprentice member, and he is a student currently at Northern Illinois University. He's a master's student.
So how can folks get more information about this ensemble and more about where these concerts are and when they're going to be and if you have to pay to get into them?
Sure, yes. All that information can be found on our website. Our website is heartlandmarimbafestival.com. And you can click on the schedule link, and there's also the address there. And if you're having trouble finding anything, you can always send us an email through that website. Our lineup this summer for our touring dates is going to start in Coralville at the West Music Recital Hall. That is Thursday, June 16th, and that's a 7 p.m. concert. And from there, June 22nd, we go to Ames, and we'll be at First United Methodist Church. The day after that, we're back in Cedar Falls at St. Luke's Episcopal Church on June 23rd at 7:30. And then we go down to Iowa City for a couple concerts, June 25th at Public Space 1 and June 26th at the Iowa City Main Library, and that is a 2 p.m. concert. From there, we head to Decorah for a concert in the Noble Recital Hall at Luther College on June 29th at 7:30. And then we're going to Chicago this year for a concert at Fourth Presbyterian Church on July 15th at 12:10 in the afternoon. And our final concert this summer is back in Waterloo at the River Loop Amphitheater, July 21st at 6:30. That venue is a great venue for summer events, and the outdoor amphitheater is really fun to play in.
Artistic director and performing artist of the Heartland Marimba Festival, Matthew Cawley. Just ahead, we'll check out the municipal band scene across Iowa. We'll hear how the Waterloo Center for the Arts is presenting a not-often-seen collection of Grantwood lithographs from their collection and the Figgies in honor of the WCA's 50th anniversary and the 125th anniversary of Wood's birth. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
I think is interesting, maybe not so much about Grant Wood, but maybe sort of complexities of his life sort of are reflective of the complexities of the state of Iowa. You know, people often talk about Iowa as being a flyover state, and, you know, what with the recent caucuses and whatnot, people are, you know, highly critical of, well, why do Iowans get to vote first? And the reality is that when you dig deeper, you see that Iowa is very complex, and voters run the gamut from right to left. And similarly, in industry and entrepreneurship and creativity and agriculture and the arts and education, Iowa is an extremely complex state. And in a way, Grant Wood and his life are reflective of that complexity, that both city and rural, and intellectual and not intellectual, and liberal and conservative and entrepreneurial and, you know, an otherwise creative place. And I think that he is a good sort of a symbol or a figurehead for the state in all his complexities. So to me, he makes a great spokesmodel for for the state of Iowa.
Most people are aware that Grant Wood comes from Iowa and he's a great artist, and they probably are aware of American Gothic and know what that is and associate that with him. But, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize how much they have in their back door, how many Grant Wood resources that are just within a few hours drive or a few minutes drive, actually. The biggest, greatest collections of Grant Wood art here in Waterloo, in Cedar Rapids, in Davenport, in Dubuque. There's Grant Wood's studio in Cedar Rapids. There's the wonderful stained glass windows that he created at Veterans Memorial Coliseum. There is Stone City, the place where he worked and where he's buried and his family is laid to rest. There's the American Gothic House as well. And so all of these places are things that we can visit and experience in a way that no other part of the world has these things here available to them. We are Grant Wood tourist country, and we should take advantage of that. We have the opportunity to experience his work and his country firsthand. You know, he has left a really enduring and valuable legacy, and we are lucky to be able to enjoy it here in Iowa.
This exhibition is kind of really going to be looking at not only the starts of our permanent collection dating back to 63, but it's also going to be kind of looking at the start of all of the different collections. I mean, in the start of our kind of prestigious collection of Haitian artwork starting in 1977, and then looking at a lot of major artists like Richard Hunt, Mauricio Lisansky, and bringing out these pieces that haven't been shown in quite a while. And so it's probably going to be in the upwards of like 100 to 200 pieces in the exhibition. I mean, it's actually going to be a celebration of not only the starts and the kind of major turns in our collection, but all the major artists that are represented, as well as all the scholars throughout the years that we've connected to, and donors. And so some of the works will be pieces that might have been commissioned specifically for the Art Center, or commissioned in memory of specific kind of people within our community. So it's going to be a kind of a I want to say, a juxtaposition of these pieces that kind of mark art history, along with very kind of recent contemporary pieces that have been collected in recent years. Works from research trips in Haiti that kind of expand not only our Caribbean collection, but also our American Decorative Arts collection, and of course our Midwest collection, which the Grant Wood exhibit is kind of one of those kind of big centerpieces of the work that we have in within the collection at the Waterloo Center for the Arts.
Ken Shankel, the Waterloo Center for the Arts Executive Director, and the WCA's curator, Sean Page, along with Andrew Wallace, the Manager of Collections and Exhibitions at the Figge Art Museum. Ken Shankel.
As we recognize our 50th anniversary in our facility, we wanted to do something special. And one of the really core parts of our collection, one of the things that many of our visitors come specifically to see, is our Grant Wood collection. And just happened to coincide with this anniversary that we were able to kind of reach some milestones with that collection. Grant Wood created 19 lithographs during the course of his lifetime. And we were kind of closing in on that number. We were, you know, 13, then 14, and 15. And just over the last year or so, we were able to acquire the remaining 4 pieces so to complete our set of the lithographs of Grant Wood. And that's pretty rare. There aren't many institutions that would have that full set of prints. We're so excited about that. Of course, immediately we wanted to put them out on the gallery walls, but we exercised a little restraint and held them back so that we could bring them out in celebration of this anniversary. Also, last year we were on a trip visiting the Figge, and we were given a tour of the vaults and noticed that they had one of these charcoal sketches for the history of penmanship. And we had one from that series in our collection as well. And we asked about the disposition of the others because there were 5 in the set and nobody really knew. So we went back and did some research and found out that actually all the other 4 pieces were in the collection at the Figge, but they weren't framed, and so they were in drawers. And we said, this is a great opportunity to get this set of drawings together, which likely haven't been shown together since they were first created in 1933.
Sean, how do you feel about Grant Wood and having this exhibit at the Waterloo Center for the Arts?
Well, I mean, in the 15 years that I've been at the Arts Center, I have gotten a chance to kind of really look into the lithographs that we've had, and being a printmaker by trade before I ended up coming to the university, I've just always loved, I would say, his kind of penmanship, his line quality of the actual work. So as an artist and actually seeing some of his techniques, I've kind of like been able to really appreciate his approach. Though it's not stylistically the type of work that I do, I still have kind of grown to really love his lithographs. And, you know, from some sense, I mean, that he's using a very kind of simple, very kind of realistic kind of view, and yet still stylistic of kind of the landscapes and the rolling hills of Iowa. But I guess as an abstract artist myself, seeing how he does his toning with his crayon and actually seeing the texture of the stone come through with the drawing of the sheep and with the drawing of like kind of the different clouds. I mean, it's just so finely detailed that I completely appreciate. I mean, it's almost like every single line is very deliberate and yet still very precise, but it still has like this kind of free, kind of playful, kind of whimsy in looking at some of the images that we do have.
And Grant Wood is really known well for his paintings. So it's really a great opportunity to see those drawings because he was an incredible draftsman. I mean, if you look at these images that are just made up of black and white marks, black marks on white, actually, you see his great lexicon of mark making, all these textures he creates and how he builds up forms and shapes and so forth. And it's incredibly controlled, but it's very effective. And it also, I think, is a great way to kind of get some clues into his compositional strategies. A lot of these prints, if you look at them, you can very clearly, distinctly see one of the strategies he used, which was to divide each side of the frame into thirds and then draw diagonal lines connecting those dots and lie significant elements of the composition along those diagonals, which created very stable compositions, but also very dynamic compositions with lots of kind of crisscrossing diagonals. And if people come and see the exhibit, they'll be able to pick those out very clearly. And I think it's maybe important to note that Grant Wood had a relatively short career and a relatively short life. You know, he really kind of gained prominence and fame around 1929, and he passed away in 1941 at the age of 51. So his career was kind of compressed, and the prints were made primarily during the 1930s up until shortly before his death.
So let's hear about these other two works that you discovered that the Figge had.
It's from a series called History of Penmanship, and it was created in 1933 for the Chicago World's Fair. They were commissioned by the Palmer Method Company, and those of us of a certain age probably remember going to elementary school and having to learn to write using the Palmer Method. So this was a company that kind of promoted that style of writing and training students to write that way. And so for the World's Fair, they commissioned Grant Wood to do these five pieces kind of representing the history of how writing evolved. And it starts out with picture writing from the Stone Age, a representation of Greeks using a stylus and wax tablet. There's a medieval monk using a brush to do manuscripts. And then we have the colonial penman in our collection using the feather quill. And then finally, the modern secretary in a modern office with a metropolitan skyline out the window using the modern method of for that time, which was a pen and an inkwell. And so these were studies for that series, and I don't think they've ever been shown together before. The Figge had four, we had one, and now they're coming together to be shown as a group. And we've loved Grant Wood for a long time, and I think we were showing and featuring Grant Wood as a key component of our collection before it was cool. Before, I think, you know, there was a time where scholars had kind of dismissed Grant Wood and looked at his work as being perhaps a little bit saccharine or nostalgic. But I don't think that that was really fair. I mean, and there are a lot of things that fed into that. Some of the politics of the time and some of the leading scholars of the time and their personal interactions with Wood kind of colored the way they represented him. But Grant Wood's work has been reevaluated very much since then. And it does reflect and connect with the common people of the time. However, it's also very sophisticated with lots of deep symbolic meaning and unique stylistic elements.
Ken Shankle, the Waterloo Center for the Arts Executive Director, and the WCA's curator, Sean Page. Sean fills us in on the official start of the Center's Grant Wood exhibit and other works in their exceptional collection.
We are having basically a grand unveiling of both the reunion of the history of penmanship as well as our complete set of the Grant Wood lithographs, and then showing our entire collection of not only additional paintings that we have in our collection and drawings. Since this is a kind of key part of our permanent collection, we're also in celebration of our own building's history or anniversary of 50 years. We are going to be showcasing kind of selections across those 50 years or across the decades of other parts of our collection at the Waterloo Center for the Arts. And all of it will be kind of celebrated in a opening reception and gallery talk on June 22nd.
So how can folks get more information about this Grant Wood lithographs and history of penmanship and this 50 years of collecting at the Waterloo Center for the Arts?
You can definitely kind of pick up information about the exhibition on our website at waterloocenterforthearts.org, as well as we're going to have quite a bit of featurettes put on Facebook. You can find us under Waterloo Center for the Arts via Facebook as well.
And hopefully come out to the reception on June 22nd at the Center for the Arts. That will be at 6 p.m. And we will be presenting a gallery talk, and people will be able to find out even more about Grant Wood.
The Waterloo Center for the Arts Executive Director Kent Shankle and the WCA's curator Sean Page. Both the Grant Wood and the 50 Years exhibits continue at the Center through September 30th. Along with sharing the Waterloo Center for the Arts with the Waterloo Community Playhouse, the WCP will be celebrating their anniversary with Singing in the Rain at the Waterloo River Loop Amphitheater on July 8th. The WCA is also the proud home of the world-class Phelps Children's Museum. Davenport's Figge Art Museum is presenting The Wonderful World of Oz from June 21st through September 25th. Just ahead, Harold Hill has nothing on Iowa's municipal band scene. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
Well, it's summertime and people want to get out and relax and see their neighbors and friends, kick back and just listen to some live music. Okay, this is on the radio, but they want to see folks they know making good music. And the bands today play all kinds of music, the traditional and, of course, the marches by Carole King and Fillmore and Sousa and Goldman and all those other fine composers. But people enjoy getting out into the air, and it's a social thing, and it's kind of a human thing, too. You know, you got plenty of technology in your world, and you got the usual concerns, but when you're in the park listening to the band, gosh, you can just take it easy and smell the roses.
Well, it gives, I think, Denny and myself an opportunity to work with some really terrific musicians, which is always fun as a musician, whether you're playing or conducting or whatever. So that it's a real joy and a real pleasure to work with fellow musicians. And we hope that the people that come to hear us appreciate the hard work that the musicians put in to play a concert, because usually we rehearse one evening and then play a concert the next evening. So that sort of dictates some of the literature we play, some of the music we do.
And the nice thing about Cedar Falls and Waterloo is we share some musicians. Oh. I know we've got at least half a dozen that play in both bands. We rehearse Monday, play on Tuesday. They rehearse Wednesday and play on Thursday. And some of these folks play on the weekends. But I like the whole picture of so many people working together. Not only the musicians, and we have a lot of tradition in our group, but also the people that come and the people that support us, who make donations. The friends of the band are a support group, and they're so generous and helpful with their donations. And the Rotary Club popcorn concession stand, you can smell this concert before you see it, but as you're coming into the park, it's wonderful. But it's the whole picture and all the relationships that we've forged over the years through the schools and the city departments, who are wonderful, by the way, and so many people that help us do what we do, and they like to be part of that picture.
Yeah, I should put in a plug for the people who take the chairs and stands and percussion down to the river loop, because they have to haul all of that stuff down there. They have to set up the chairs, set up the stands, and then take them down and then set them up the next night. So there's an awful lot of behind the scenes. You know, people just walk in and there's the band ready to go, and not realizing all that it has taken to make that happen. So thankful for those people.
Bill Shepherd, conductor and musical director of the Waterloo Municipal Band, and conductor and music director of the Cedar Falls Municipal Band, Dennis Downs. All across the state, municipal and community bands are tuning up for the summer. Bill fills us in on some Iowa band history.
I think the greatest impetus for the beginning of bands came after World War I, because before that time, orchestras were the prime musical organizations. And, of course, there was no music in schools. So when World War I ended, there had been some military bands, of course. And then, of course, John Philip Sousa was a powerful influence. And when some of these folks came back from the war as musicians, they didn't have any place to play. And they got into a little bit of the teaching of music and trying to get music into the schools, which was a long, drawn-out process. Then instead of having school bands, they had people in the community that would play in the bands. The high school kids came later. And, of course, Carole King was one of the driving forces behind the Iowa band law. Now, Carole King and some of the other good Iowa band directors went to the legislature and had them pass this law that would allow a community to set aside money to fund town band, municipal band, whatever you want to call it. And he was a fabulous writer of marches and other kinds of music. So he was an extremely talented man and a wonderful person.
And like Bill said, Carole King, who is originally from Ohio, we like to claim him as an Iowan because he lived here more years, and he has a strong circus background. He joined the circus when Barnum and Bailey's circus and a couple of other circuses,
yes,
Floto.
Mm-hmm.
He played baritone and trumpet and led the band and wrote Barnum and Bailey's favorite march. His famous march was done overnight, and he had to do it right now, and it came out pretty well. And we all play it, I think, every season. But he came from a circus background, and there are circus bands back into the 1800s.
Well, both of your bands are celebrating some terrific anniversaries this year, and Denny, you're coming in at 125 years for the Cedar Falls Municipal Band. Tell us a little bit about what you have going this year for your season.
All right, thank you. We have 125 years of continuous service since 1891. We do have roots back to 1857, and we've got the pictures to prove it. And where you'll see young men, boys even, about 20 of them in a row, with their brass instruments and a drum or two. And that was more of a military band and a convention band. But we got the support from the Ancient Order of United Workers. Okay, that's one of those old fraternities. And they supported the band along with the commercial club, now the Chamber of Commerce. And Frank Fitzgerald, along with Brian Kilborn, back in 1891, got the place, the money, the support, and the literature, and the people to do it with. So that's when you look at a group and say, there, that's a band, that's a continual, you've got a regular conductor, and so we take it from there, and then the rest is history.
And the Cedar Falls Municipal Band, you also have some cool things in that you have a museum, you have a book. Tell us just briefly about that.
The book is the history of the Cedar Falls Band was put together by Justin and Karen Nelson. Justin passed away last September, so our opening concert, June 7th, will be in memory of Justin, and it'll be the opening of our 125th. We call it the celebration season. It's also our 20th year on the band shell in Overman Park.
And then you have this museum as well, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, and Justin did so much in that museum and so much for that old library and so many things that you see there. And so he and I and some other people worked on that for many years. And that was the original home. The band was incorporated in 1916. And then we bought the building in 17. And it houses lots of old instruments, including Kilborn's original sousaphone from 1894. But there's lots of documents, and the original band hall that Sousa visited in the late 20s when he played in the Hippodrome, which is Cattle Congress, and he thought this is the best thing he's seen west of the Mississippi. So he thought it was terrific that we had that hall. But since then, about 11 years ago, we bought the newer building. It's open by appointment through Mark Welty, who is our host at the museum now. But lots of things to see, the new place is where we do our rehearsals, and we have other things. We have percussion lessons and rehearsals. The Cedar Valley Big Band rehearses there, and lots of ensembles.
Well, a terrific season ahead, and hats off to the Cedar Falls Municipal Band for celebrating their 125th anniversary. And the Waterloo Municipal Band is celebrating their 90th anniversary. Bill, tell us a bit about the history behind the Waterloo Band and a bit about what you have in store for you this year.
Well, the story goes that there are a couple of fellows from Waterloo on a ship in World War I, and they thought that Waterloo should have a band. And they tried a couple of times without success, and then when they got back after the war. And then finally, I guess in 1926, that they were able to get a functioning band. And it was a VFW band. And they played a lot of conventions for the VFW. Back in the records, that they went to Louisville, Kentucky. They marched in parades in Chicago. Were sort of an extension of the VFW at that time. But there was a fire in that building, and I guess lost instruments, uniforms, music. Then, at that point, there was no place for them to rehearse, and the VFW sort of, I think, withdrew their support. Then along came what they called the Musicians Trust Fund. That was money out of New York City. A penny or two of every recording would be sent out to areas all across the country to support live music. And the band used those funds to support the band. And that was a union event, a musicians' union. And then it got to be a real problem dealing with that green sheet you had to fill out to get paid for those jobs. And the upshot of that is that the hotel motel tax funds the band, and that's where the financial support comes for the Waterloo Band.
And in 2012, Waterloo finally gave you a terrific spot to perform.
Yes, we played at Burns Park, and I was very concerned about going down to the River Loop and playing a concert there. But we went in, played the first concert, and boy, as soon as we played that first tune, it was like, oh, this is great. And I know they didn't plan it that way, but it turned out to be a terrific place to play.
It's a marvelous addition to our community. Well, let's talk about not only the Cedar Falls and the Waterloo Municipal Bands, but there are going to be concerts all across the state.
These are some of the bands across the state of Iowa, and we would really encourage you to go out and support these bands because the musicians have practiced and they made an effort to put together a concert for you. So there may be some differences in times or days or whatever, but please check out your local newspaper, radio station, public radio, and see if you can find the time and place that these area bands are playing. And let me just list a few. The Greater Des Moines Community Band is their 29th season. Ames Municipal Band, 106th season. Cedar Rapids Municipal Band, 66th season. The Carl King Municipal Band of Fort Dodge, 96th. Iowa Military Veterans Band, only the 20th season. Sioux City Municipal Band, 96th season. Boone Municipal Band, 108th season.
And when you and I say bands, a lot of our audience, or some of our audience, would say, oh, guitars up on a stage, six people. Mm-hmm. These are 40, give or take, 40-piece bands, and these are acoustic instruments.
Good point. It's a concert band.
Yeah, that's a concert band. Quad City Wind Ensemble, 30th season, and the Winterset Community Band in its 105th season, Urbandale Community Adult Band, Storm Lake Municipal Band, Marshalltown Municipal Band, the Marion Community Band, now in its 35th season, Tri-State Wind Ensemble, Wind Symphony in Dubuque, and that's in its 21st season, the DeWitt Area Community Band, the Oskaloosa Municipal Band, 152nd season, although not continuous, but total, 152nd season, got to get that in, Iowa City Community Band, 58th season, and Charles City has their 36th season.
Conductor and music director of the Cedar Falls Municipal Band, Dennis Downs, and Bill Shepard, conductor and musical director of the Waterloo Municipal Band. Don't miss out on one of Iowa's time-honored traditions. Head to the park and enjoy some great band performances. And be sure to stay with Iowa Public Radio for some live performance broadcasts this summer as well. Plus, June is the end of IPR's fiscal year. If you would like to help safeguard IPR's future and all of the great programming, please donate at iowapublicradio.org. To hear more from all the guest interviews on today's Iowa Arts Showcase, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Arts Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner, Phil Moss, and John Pemble. Program research was provided by Rachel Berenger. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.